What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, yeah, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there, yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyers in the house.
And we welcome you in the Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus, with the Legal Eagles battling it up on different sides of the spectrum. Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. I am Sam Panayotovich. Plenty of things to get to. Of course, we'll close with the legal grab bag, but we open up the show. Tom Kircher is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Emily Matisik, reporter for WBAY Action 2 News, based out of Green Bay. They both join us this morning in Chicago on WGN Plus. How are you?
Good morning.
All right, so Emily, you were the lead reporter for WBAY, the Green Bay, Wisconsin ABC affiliate. You're featured prominently in the Netflix series. What did you think of the finished product? Was it an accurate depiction of what was going on during the trial?
Well, I guess I was shocked after almost 10 years that it actually came to fruition. The two producers had been around since 2005 covering the case and always said they wanted to create a documentary. So you can imagine my surprise in November when Netflix put out a release saying that they would be releasing a 10-part series. So that was kind of shocking in and of itself. As far as the series itself, I give the two women a lot of credit for putting something together. We sat through hundreds of hours of testimony, saw thousands or more than or close to 1,000 pieces of evidence in the case, and they were able to dwindle it down to 10 hours. Did it include everything that was included at trial? No. Did they cover some of the high points? Yes. Did they miss some other points? Yes. But if you wanted to see the whole trial and the whole case, then you should have come to Manitowoc County from November of 2005 through April of 2007 to see everything.
So now, obviously, this story and the series Making a Murderer has exploded, not only in the U.S., but all over the world. Did you have any sense at the time when you were covering the story how big it would become?
No, I think in Northeast Wisconsin, it was a huge story. I think Stephen Avery's story was a big story. This man who spent 18 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit to be exonerated and then to be charged with this other brutal crime was a big story. I think it grabbed some headlines initially, but as it sort of went through the court system, I don't think anybody outside of Northeast Wisconsin necessarily paid attention to the story. So, yeah, now that it's kind of taken off on the worldwide scale, I'm shocked.
You know, the documentary kind of paints it in a picture that the Manitowoc Police Department was out to get Stephen Avery. That's what the way it came through, at least in the Netflix documentary. But as you were going through that, did you get that sense while you were covering the trial?
Not at all. I didn't think that there was any sort of vendetta against Stephen Avery on behalf of the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Department.
So, Tom, how did you first become involved with the Avery case?
I wrote the story in 2003 saying that he would be released from prison after 18 years. There was new DNA testing that became available that proved that another man committed the sexual assault that Avery was convicted of.
And did your reporting have anything to do with his ultimate exoneration in that case, do you think?
No, at that stage, the Wisconsin Innocence Project, which is based at the University of Wisconsin Law School, was representing him and had made possible the testing to prove that he was not guilty. So by the time I got to the story, it was all but certain that he would be released from prison. He was a short time later, and I and other reporters were there when he walked out of the prison gates one day.
So when he was released, did you get a sense? I mean, obviously the series depicts a government, a police force that, you know, almost immediately after he's released for the first crime is conspiring to get him again. Was there any sense in real time when he was exonerated the first time that the police were unhappy, that the state's attorney was going to ultimately, you know, get them. Did you have any sense like that?
Well, I wouldn't have been close enough to that, but I think it's fair to say that the Sheriff's Department of Manitowoc County and the Avery family, you know, have been at odds, and there's mistrust on both sides, and you know, maybe even some enmity. I mean, the sheriff was just on television the other day. He was asked, you know, did you apologize to Stephen Avery for the wrongful conviction? He said no, and I was just doing my job, and, you know, I wouldn't apologize today. And, you know, so, and, you know, Stephen Avery, before the sexual assault case, you know, did have some run-ins with the law. Again, I think there was friction between his family and the sheriff's department. I don't know, I'm sure they were not happy to find that they had, you know, targeted the wrong man in that sexual assault case. I did do some reporting after Avery was released that showed that the sheriff's department ignored leads that would have pointed them to the guy who was ultimately connected to the sexual assault through the DNA evidence. So, you know, conspiracy, that's sort of another level. You know, it's one thing to have friction between the two sides and, you know, some dislike. To say there was a conspiracy, you know, that obviously is much harder to prove.
Emily, did you actually watch the Netflix documentary?
Oh, yeah, I watched it from in about 2.5 days' time.
I know, with the cold weather, right? Just lock yourself in.
It was around the holidays, so
yeah.
Trying to get ready for the holidays and watch it, because I knew I was going to have to do some follow-up stories on it, so absolutely watched it the first weekend it came out.
Okay, then my question is, you know, there's a lot going on the internet right now about what evidence was not included in the Netflix series. Can you just walk us through a couple of items that were present in the trial but not included in the Netflix documentary?
Well, her cell phone and her camera were found in the burn barrel outside Stephen Avery's home. He had specifically requested her to come out to the salvage yard to take pictures when he called Auto Trader. Had used the name B. Yonda, which is his sister's name, not his name. The sister lived in the trailer next to him. When he had called Halbach's cell phone number, he used *69 to disguise the number that it was coming from.
How about the bleach? How about the bleach on Dassey's jeans?
The bleach on Brendan Dassey's jeans that he said he had helped his Uncle Steve clean up the garage. The DNA evidence on the hood latch of Teresa Halbach's vehicle that was found on the salvage yard property. I mean, this was 10 years ago. I'm lucky if I remember what I had for breakfast yesterday,
The other thing that's compelling,
10 years ago,
you know, the cat murder, I mean, that got a lot of attention both in the series and on the internet. What wasn't, I mean, it's depicted in the Netflix series like it was some youthful indiscretion. I mean, in fact, you know, Avery doused this cat with gasoline and lit it on fire. It's not really depicted that way in the series, right?
Right. They sort of kind of glazed over it as it was, just, you know, guys messing around with a campfire, but he deliberately did kill the cat in the fire.
So as a reporter, I mean, both of you can answer this, because I mean, what's your take on, you know, the filmmakers, I'm not going to call it suppressing information, but, you know, not portraying information that would tend to inculpate Mr. Avery? I mean, what do you think of that?
I think they told the story sort of from their point of view. They can pick and choose what they wanted to put into the series, and that's kind of what they did in their eyes, thinking that they were telling the full story. I mean, they have said repeatedly they weren't trying to prove Stephen Avery's innocence. They were just simply putting together a story, a look at the justice system, potentially its failings.
You know, and one of the ways that they framed it too is that this is just a view of the justice system and how it affects the poor or the indigent. But in reality, I mean, Stephen Avery had a lot of money to spend on defense attorneys. I mean, he had that settlement from Manitowoc that essentially funded his defense. So it wasn't like he was stuck with, you know, a public defender that was incompetent. I mean, he had good representation.
Yeah, I think if you ask other attorneys, they'll tell you that Jerry Buting and Dean Strang are some of the best defense attorneys, probably not only just in the state, but kind of in the region as well.
Just to jump in on that, I think I think in fairness to the filmmakers, you could sort of pick to death the various facts that weren't included, and I think you could say the same of a lot of our news stories. That, well, what about this detail? What about that? What about this inconsistency? There's maybe almost no end to that sort of thing. So I guess I was less bothered by what's left out of the film because it's just a reality. But I think what people need to remember as they're, watching the series and trying to weigh it is that it is told from the perspective of Stephen Avery, his families, and his lawyers. So, I think as long as you keep that in mind and watching the presentation, it's fine. And especially if you can balance that with, reading news coverage of the trial. But just imagine, obviously people have been extremely riled up by the show and how it's presented, but just imagine how different the feel of making a murder would be had the filmmakers essentially been embedded with the Theresa Halbach family and prosecutors. So, again, I don't fault the approach. I just think it's important to keep in mind where they came from.
Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. Tom Kircher, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Emily Matesik is a reporter for WBAY Action 2 News, both extremely close to the Stephen Avery case. Emily, you were starting to say something right there. I'll just give you the floor again.
Yeah, I mean, this case was tried in the court of law. A jury sat there and heard almost 6 weeks of testimony in Stephen Avery's trial, 2 weeks of testimony in his nephew Brendan Dassey's trial, and they reached their verdict based on everything that they heard. This case is, again, being tried sort of in the court of public opinion based on what people are seeing in this series, which isn't the complete story.
There was one quote by the judge who he was the trial judge. And then it was the appeal or the post-conviction hearing where he or maybe it was the sentencing. But I remember this quote because it made me think there must be something left out. But he said, your crimes against people are becoming increasingly more violent. And that's why he was going to sentence him in that fashion. But if the conviction for the 18 years prison sentence was overturned, what crimes was the judge referencing are becoming more violent? I mean, there's a big gap in the time period there between the crimes that he committed.
Well, I think they're talking about the cat incident and the robbery convictions that he had. There was the other run-in with the sheriff's deputy's wife where he accused of running her off the road. I think those are the crimes that they were talking about.
I want to talk about the press conferences because that was a prominent feature of the series, and it seemed bizarre. I mean, one press conference where the prosecutor laid out his theory, Ken Kress laid out his theory in detail of what happened. How did that seem to you when you were covering it? Did it seem a little unusual, or in covering these kind of cases, is that typical for these kind of prosecutions?
I guess as a reporter, I don't know if I've covered a case like this to this extent.
I mean, have you covered many cases where a prosecutor came out and basically laid out to the public in, very gory details what happened? I mean, that seemed like, too much information to disclose to the public at that time. That's at least how it was depicted in the film, I think.
I think I've covered some news conferences, whether it's with sheriff's departments when they make an arrest for a crime or something like that, where they may get into detail. But again, I feel like this crime is not your run-of-the-mill crime that reporters are covering every day. This was a brutal homicide. Search parties had been out searching for this woman, that kind of thing. So I don't think I've ever covered anything like it, nor do I know if I ever will cover anything like it in the future.
I would agree with that, too, although there was a little bit of an over-the-top feeling to it, I think. It wasn't just holding a news conference and stating the allegations. The prosecutor, Ken Kratz, kind of went to some extra effort. It's being broadcast on live television in Wisconsin. And, if there are young people around, don't let them watch this. And, so there was sort of extra drama inserted into it. And it's interesting, too, the other day he was doing a television interview and saying, if I had to do it again, I would not have done that news conference. I would have just simply released the complaint itself, which, of course, had plenty of detail as well.
Yeah, I saw that. Tom, what do you think? Have you followed up at all with any of the I'm not going to call them or any of the key people who we've seen in the series. Len Kaczynski, Kratz, have either of you followed up with any of the attorneys or other people involved?
I have not. The only writing I've done on this outside of Twitter is an analysis piece, just taking a look at what was presented in Making a Murderer and reflecting on what we reported during the trial, but I haven't been in touch with any of the other players.
I have. I did an interview with Ken Kratz, I want to say the Monday after the series was released. Didn't talk to him. I was the only local reporter that he talked to after it came out, and he kind of laid out the things that the series had left out, things that he's, you know, since been talking to on kind of the national. I've talked to some of the investigators who don't want to talk on camera just because of the appeals process and stuff like that. Ken's not really involved in the case anymore because he stepped down from his position as the Calumet County District Attorney. So he's kind of more free, I think, to talk publicly than some of the other players in it.
Both Tom and Emily, we appreciate your time talking about Making a Murderer in the Stephen Avery case. But I think the more, you know, pressing question, I have the sports background. How many more Hail Marys does Aaron Rodgers have in him? Come on. Are you kidding me? He pulled against Arizona, too? What was the reaction like there in Wisconsin when Aaron Rodgers almost single-handedly brought them back in that game?
Well, Emily's there in Green Bay.
Yeah, and I'll go on record. I'm not a native. I bleed black and gold. I grew up in the suburbs of
Steelers fan.
I'm a Steelers fan,
boo.
But when he threw that ball, or when they were driving down the field on Saturday, and I looked at my boyfriend, I go, they're going to win this game. And they, you know, they came up short. But I also love Larry Fitzgerald. He went to the University of Pittsburgh. So, you know, as long as the Patriots don't win the Super Bowl, I'll be happy.
Hey, Tom.
I hate the Patriots, and I hate Tom Brady and Bill Belichick.
Wow, we all agree on that.
Let's go on record.
Hey, Tom, you wrote a book about Brett Favre. Is Rodgers now, has he cemented himself as a better quarterback than Favre? I think yes. I think it's a no-brainer. What do you think?
It depends what your measure is, you know. Favre was just so entertaining, so many highs and lows, you know, the terrible interceptions, the crazy left-hand, underhand passes, you know, just the joy running into the end zone, picking up a player and throwing him over his shoulder after a touchdown. And, you know, there's all of that. And he, you know, at this point, they're even in terms of Super Bowls. But as a pure passer, pure quarterback, I'd say Aaron's got the edge, and as far as his completed Hail Marys, that's just more proof of God smiling on the Green Bay Packers.
Emily Matesic and Tom Kircher. She still hates Tom Brady, for the record.
I will go on record and let you know that at one point, the two most powerful men in Green Bay were Pittsburghers. Bishop Zubik, who's now the bishop of the Catholic Diocese of Pittsburgh, and Mike McCarthy. Two good yinzers right there.
Thank you both for joining us on WGN. Take care.
Have a good one.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich's partner at Rice, Downey & Lenkoff and represents Fortune 500 companies and small business in workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2014. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their continued growth is a result of their aggressive, results-oriented approach that their clients trust. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among our other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN. The following has been a paid advertisement by the firm of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. We are now going to turn to a very prominent case of a Chicago man who was freed after spending 10 years in jail. We're very privileged to have Professor Joshua Tepfer from the University of Chicago Law School and also from the Exoneration Project. Professor, thanks for joining us on WGN Plus.
Well, thank you for having me.
Professor, you have been with the University of Chicago and specifically the Exoneration Project since 2015. You're a lecturer. You also represent the criminally accused. You have represented the criminally accused for over a decade. Is that correct?
That's right. I was at the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern for about 7 years before this.
And you were an attorney with the Chicago Office of the State Appellate Defender. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Great. Well, obviously in the news, in addition to your story, has been Making a Murder. We're going to be covering that later on Chicago, or on Legal Face-Off here. Obviously in the news has been these cases of police corruption, shootings. We've covered that extensively on Legal Face-Off. Tell us about your client, Ben Baker. Give us a little background about it, please.
Sure. Ben Baker was arrested in March of 2005. And throughout the proceedings leading to his trial and then at his trial, a bench trial in Cook County, Illinois, he testified to what seemingly was this outlandish story of police corruption. He was arrested for a significant amount of drugs on his possession and with intent to deliver, supposedly. But what he said happened was that all those drugs were planted on him. They were put on him led by a sergeant named Ronald Watts. And they were put on him because he refused to bribe Ronald Watts, a corrupt officer. Watts solicited him for about $1,000. Baker refused and in retaliation put this case on him.
So let me stop you here because, I mean, it's just fascinating stuff. So your client, who was at the time around 33, right, was arrested. And he the allegation was that he was running a drug ring out of the Ida B. Wells public housing complex, which was in the Wentworth Police District, right, which is now that complex is shuttered, right?
Correct. That complex is no longer there.
And the officer you mentioned, Watts, testified under oath that he arrested your client in the lobby, and then in the search they found heroin, crack cocaine, and about $800 in his pocket, correct?
Watts testified to that, as well as three other members of his crew.
Okay. And then at trial, which was a bench trial here in Cook County, your client Baker said that this was planted on him, right?
He said this. It was totally framed. It was planted on him, and it was in retaliation for his refusing a bribe attempt from Watts previously.
And what was the reaction from the state's attorney and the judge to that allegation?
It was outlandish. And I should say, Baker didn't just testify to this. He went to the Chicago Police Internal Affairs Division. He filed reports, complaints, OPS. His wife did too. This was something that he had been saying for a long time. The judge ruled against him and said, you know, it was outlandish, and if there was even a hint of corroboration, maybe there would be a different story, but there wasn't. So it was four police officers against Ben Baker's story.
And the judge, Michael Tooman in Cook County, found, as you said, Baker guilty on both counts and initially sentenced him to 18 years in prison and reduced the term to 14 years, correct?
Right. That's a big sentence.
Big sentence. And the judge at the resentencing said that the accusations that Watts and officers under his command had framed Mr. Baker fell on their face, right? He said they held no water at all. Like you mentioned, Professor, he said that if there had been some corroboration, there might have been a different story, right?
That's right.
So that's in March 2005 or sometime after that when he's sentenced, goes to prison. Where was he where was he serving his time?
You know, he served throughout the state. The trial, all that happened in June 2006, actually. So
okay.
Pending trial. And he was most recently at Robinson Correctional Center downstate.
What kind of place is Robinson Correctional Center?
You know, Robinson is... It's an Illinois prison, but it's probably one of the easier ones to spend your time, I guess. Ultimately, it's a lower security prison, but
lots of drug offenders, I assume.
There's drugs. I don't know a huge amount about it, but the Department of Corrections in Illinois, regardless of where you are, is not a pleasant place to be.
All right. So your client starts serving in 07. And what during the period of 07 until just recently, what's going on? Is he trying to appeal? Is he talking to your colleagues at the Exoneration Project? Tell us what happens during that interim.
Well, he files a direct appeal and he loses, as he had an appointed attorney. And then he filed motions, as many innocent clients do, to try to get it vacated. The most important thing he filed ultimately was in 2012 or 2013, after Sergeant Ronald Watts, who we've mentioned was federally indicted and ultimately pled guilty to a single count of doing the exact same type of thing, shaking down individuals in this housing complex.
So let's pause it there. We'll pick up with Watts in a moment, but I'm interested in your take, having handled many exonerations in the past, your take on the appellate process, also being a veteran of that process. You know, many of us were compelled by Making a Murder and dismayed by the hearings that we saw, in which, the court-appointed lawyers weren't portrayed as very efficient. The process wasn't portrayed on the show as being very fair. Is it your take in the Baker cases, or a case in similar cases, that appellate procedure doesn't result in exonerations very frequently?
I mean, the direct appellate process is not tailor-made to seek out wrongful convictions. What it is it's a review on a more higher level of whether there was legal problems in this case, or in any case, whether there was constitutional problems and things along those lines. But when this case came down to two wildly different stories, whether or not four police officers testifying to finding drugs on Ben Baker, and one person testifying, Ben Baker, that this entire thing was a sham and a shakedown from corrupt police officers. That's a determination that has to be ferreted out, and determinations made by people who hear the testimony. And appellate courts are really not equipped to review that testimony and find and say, well, I think the trial judge got it wrong. I think those four police officers were all lying. I mean, that's not really, they're not in a position to do that. So I don't necessarily blame the appellate court or any appellate attorneys for failing to ferret this out earlier.
So fast forward to October 2013, federal court judge Sharon Coleman convicts Ronald Watts, the same officer that you mentioned, who was a 19-year police veteran, who resigned before pleading guilty. She sentenced him to 22 months in jail, correct?
Correct.
Which was actually longer than the federal sentencing guidelines. And he pled guilty to, like you mentioned, Professor, the very thing that your client had said happened to him, right?
He did a very similar thing. He was caught on a wire doing taking a bribe from a confidential federal informant.
Turns out that Sergeant Watts was treating this development and others as, what, an ATM almost? He was getting bribes. He was getting payoffs from informants and drug dealers, correct?
He was. And this isn't just me saying it. These are sworn statements from whistleblowing police officers who cooperated with the FBI, who, and I quote, one of them, and I quote, in a deposition testimony said, Watts was running a criminal enterprise out of this complex.
Yeah, I mean, the judge, Judge Sharon Coleman, who I've appeared before, you know, excellent judge, said you were a sergeant operating in a community that should hold you up as an example. You needed to protect those people, and you didn't. So Watts pleads guilty, and then what effect does that have on Ben Baker?
Almost none. I mean, Ben Baker, based on this, files a pleading in his own handwritten language. You know, I didn't know about him. No one knows about him. And it was just another one of the pleadings that get pro se pleadings gets thrown in the one of the busiest courtrooms, if not the busiest courtroom in the country, at 26th in California. And it's a huge systemic problem that those things are never taken seriously. And it just sat there. It just sat there for years, 2 years. And no one was really doing anything about it until the case came upon our radar from the former attorney, former appellate attorney from of Ben Baker, and said to one of my colleagues, I wasn't even at University of Chicago yet, and said, you guys should take a look at this case. And my colleague Liz Wong did and filed an amended motion, you know, attaching a bunch of the pleadings from Watts's federal case. And then the case still sat there, and it really wasn't done anything with that. And that is a frustrating part of the process.
When's the first time that you actually met with Mr. Baker?
Well, I spoke with him on the phone. The colleague that who had been working on the case then moved to Colorado. So she was it was hard for her to really actively litigate the case. So when I showed up at the Exoneration Project in May, I got involved in the case. I quickly got up to speed, and I realized this is a lot bigger than just Watts' federal indictment. And we started getting documents from the federal investigation, FOIAing documents. And what we got was mostly redacted, but what we FOIAed the Cook County State's Attorney's Office. And I started looking into this related case, which was a whistleblowing case filed by two current Chicago police officers who were instrumental in the Watts, taking down Watts, and who have filed a lawsuit saying that they were retaliated against by the Chicago police, by top brass at the Chicago police, including the top internal affairs division, for cooperating, for breaking the blue code of silence, the blue wall of silence, I should say.
These officers have said that they have been threatened physically, that their pleas have, that their whistleblowing has been ignored, that they've been shuffled around, and they're still on the force, as you mentioned.
Yeah, they were threatened. I mean, they have testimony saying that don't call us if you're in an emergency. Good luck. Watch your car. I mean, they have some pretty heated and serious allegations.
All right. Now, lots of news that we've covered on this show about Cook County and City Hall not releasing videotapes for a year in the Laquan McDonald case, for example. Did you run into any obstruction or any difficulty getting the information from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office?
We ran into lots of roadblocks in our attempt to investigate the scope of the Watts investigation. One thing that when I stepped in, what we started to realize from the documents we're receiving is that the single charge against Watts and one other man, Khaled Muhammad, and his crew was after what was a 12 to 13 year investigation from the FBI, the Chicago Police Internal Affairs Division, and the Cook County State's Attorney's Office all working together. And the scope of that investigation, what we recovered, was astounding and incredible. And it's hard to think that I don't sound like a conspiracy theorist with this, but it's all in documents. And what we saw is that, like we said, there was a criminal enterprise led by Watts. And it wasn't just Watts. It was his crew. Police officers who were working under him in this district were, like we said, in the habit of shaking down individuals, taking bribes, framing cases, doing all sorts of illegal activity for a decade. And what we found in our documents was that 5 months, or all of this was known by the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, by the Chicago Police, as they were prosecuting Ben Baker in May of 2006. We have documents that received that in January of 2006, that the Cook County State's Attorney, that the FBI produced a document that said the Cook County State's Attorney's Office has an ongoing investigation into these allegations about Watts. Yet none of that was revealed to Baker. None of that stopped them from prosecuting Ben Baker, and none of that stopped them from vacating that conviction or doing anything about it after he was convicted and sentenced to 14 years in prison. So When we later, for example, FOIA'd the Cook County State's Attorney's Office and asked for all these documents that we know that they were investigating from back in 2006, all we got were documents from 2009 about Watts. We didn't get anything else.
Hmm.
And so that's been a problem.
Professor, can you tell us how all of this led up to Ben Baker being released?
Sure. So when we gathered all these documents, we filed a supplemental petition in the middle of December, so just a month ago, pointing out the scope of what we discovered about how this was not a single incident by Watts, but that everything that Baker testified to in 2006 has been corroborated by FBI documents, Chicago police sworn testimony, and just a mountain, two huge binders full of evidence. And to the Cook County State's Attorney's credit, they did an expedited review, and he was released in less than a month. And I've never had an experience like that where a case is opened, or at least substantially, that quickly by me, and they react that quickly. So I applaud them for that as soon as it got on their radar, or at least top brass's radar at the state's attorney's office, to act quickly.
Do you think, Professor, that some of the current political pressure might have had an influence on that?
You know, I'm hopeful that they would have acted that way no matter what. I mean, this case was as cut as dry as it gets. I think the pressure put on by the community that is not tolerating a lack of police accountability, whether it's the Black Lives Movement or the people who won't take it anymore, they are applauded. I've called this the people's exoneration because it certainly did create an atmosphere where it put the case on top brass's radar quickly.
Professor, we have about 30 seconds left, and we'll let you go. We appreciate your time. Last question is, take us inside that meeting, when Ben Baker finally hears that he's going to be released after spending 10 years in jail for something he didn't do. What's his demeanor like?
You know, it's bittersweet. It's, why did this happen? And the one thing Ben Baker has made very clear is he wants this case to have a legacy. And that's why I've been all over the media talking about this, because the collateral damage here, this has not been cleaned up. It's just started. As I've mentioned, there's three other officers, all of whom are on the force to this day, who testified to what Watts said. So they lied. And those officers were named by our whistleblowing officers throughout as part of this corrupt scheme. One of them has been promoted to sergeant. He was promoted in November 2012. Another has been involved in shootings of unarmed Black men, including Christian Green, which has been on the news, and has been at the scene of the Ronald Johnson murder as well, too. So the collateral damage by this code of silence is something that we need to keep being vigilant about, and that's why Ben Baker wants this case to be publicized.
Professor, we'd love to have you back. I mean, we could have you on for another half hour. This is so interesting. Would you come back at some point?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
This has been Professor Joshua Tepfer from the University of Chicago Law School and the Exoneration Project. For more information, you can visit exonerationproject.org. Again, Professor, thank you for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
All right, we're joined now on Legal Face-Off by Laura Wood. Laura is a staff writer with the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Laura, welcome to Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So we're going to talk to you about the Vandenberg case that Cook County Circuit Judge Daniel Lynch ruled 2 days ago that the $25 million settlement should be vacated. You covered the case, correct?
Correct.
All right. Can you give us a little background, give our listeners a little background about what led up to Tuesday's decision?
Oh,
I know it's a, I know there's a lot of information, but if you could maybe summarize it for our listeners. It's a fascinating case that we've all in the trial bar followed very closely.
Gotcha. Well, I guess the most direct background that led up to Judge Lynch's decision on Tuesday is a motion filed by the defense in this case. Brunswick is the, you know, the common name for it. Filed a motion to vacate the settlement based on the theory that plaintiff's attorney Mark McNabola committed, conspired with a court clerk to commit fraud in securing this $25 million settlement for his clients. The case had gone through a series of evidentiary hearings in October in which attorneys, the insurance adjuster, the claims adjuster for the defense, the court clerk, and at least one associate, my mind might be blanking on whether there are more, testified as to their understanding and their knowledge of what happened around the short time frame in which both the settlement was secured and when a jury consensus was reached but never entered into the court record. And then there were closing arguments in December that just kind of reiterated why each side believed the settlement should or shouldn't be vacated. And then here we were Tuesday with the judge's ruling.
Hey, Laura, so what led up to the December evidentiary hearing, just real quickly, there was a trial that went on between plaintiff and defendant right before, it was after closing arguments. The jury already went out for deliberations. And then at some point in time, there was a note passed from the jury to the judge. And can you pick it up from there just briefly to give the background?
Well, testimony kind of makes it unclear who actually received the note. But yes, the jury issued a note during its deliberations. The note was curious of whether it could allocate all of the alleged liability in this case to an empty chair defendant who had settled before trial but was still required to remain on the jury verdict form. The contents of that note was divulged to the plaintiff's attorney, but not the defense attorney. And
there was
not until 27 minutes after the plaintiff's attorney learned.
Has anyone seen the note, by the way? Has anyone ever looked at the contents, or has that been disclosed or not?
The note is in the case record. It's an attachment as an exhibit on several documents that have been filed on the case. At this point, the judge, the parties in the case, the attorneys involved, even I am very familiar with what the note says, the handwriting on the note, everything like that.
What did it say?
It said, "Can we find?" Well, I guess I don't have it right in front of my face, but
paraphrase.
They wanted to know if they could allocate all of the liability, find fault with RQM LLC, the empty chair defendant.
So the bottom line is this note that was passed by the clerk basically was good news for the remaining defendant, Brunswick, and it looked like they were going to find the remaining defendant, Brunswick, not guilty, yet the note was only given to the plaintiff's lawyer. It wasn't given to the defense lawyer for Brunswick until 27 minutes later, right?
That is how the note was interpreted.
And in that 20... I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's how the note was interpreted by the defense, yes.
And then the key thing about this whole case, the reason it's fascinated everybody, is in that 27 minutes, the plaintiff's lawyer settled the case with the defendant's insurance company directly for $25 million, right?
Yes.
Well, there have been, you know, another key piece to it, too. There have been ongoing discussions for weeks with the adjuster and the plaintiff's attorney on settlement. So it's not that it sounds so salacious that the plaintiff's attorney,
Here we go. Jason Whiteside defending this action by a fellow plaintiff's lawyer. What a shock.
But it's not that, you know, the plaintiff's attorney just reached out to the insurance company and said, "Hey, I'll take the current offer." It had been ongoing discussions. And there were discussions even that day before the note came from the jury about settlement. But I mean, obviously, it looks highly suspicious.
But obviously, Laura, back me up on this. You being in the courtroom when on Tuesday when the judge vacated the settlement, obviously, common sense, ethics dictate that the plaintiff's lawyer, Mac Nebola, should have shared this information with the Brunswick attorney, right?
That was the judge's ruling.
So what was the demand? I mean, I missed it on Tuesday. I really want to be there. Was the courtroom here at the Daily Center just packed with lawyers?
Yes. Well, I don't want to say lawyers. I don't know. You know, I don't know everybody who was in there, but the courtroom was packed. Yes.
And what was the demeanor of the judge? I mean, I read it, but what was his demeanor? Was he, upset with Mac Nebola? What was his? How did he seem?
Well, you know, he actually seemed the same way that he seemed during the evidentiary hearings. He was just, you know, just. His face was very just neutral, and he read from whatever document he had in front of him, and whatever he had on that document, he just read into the record and made his ruling. You know, you couldn't really discern any kind of frustration or, you know, relief that at least this phase of the motion has been ruled on, anything like that. I would say, throughout all of these proceedings, Judge Lynch has held just kind of a very neutral demeanor here.
Okay, and he found in his findings, Laura, he said that there was no conspiracy between Mac Nebola and the clerk, and that also he denied the directed verdict from request from the defense. Where's that at right now? Are they coming back in 30 days for another status on the case?
Well, after Judge Lynch ruled that, you know, circumstances warranted vacation of the settlement, he gave the parties an opportunity to take about, you know, a 10-minute break and decide whether or not they want to engage in new settlement negotiations. The parties indicated to him that they would like to, well, the lawyers indicated to him that they would like to speak with their clients and figure out if that's a route that they wanted to take, because that's not really anything that was on anybody's radar. Even the defense's motion, you know, requested either judgment on this jury consensus or a new trial. Nobody really thought about engaging in new settlement negotiations. So they came back from their break, and the judge indicated that during the break, the lawyers indicated they would like to discuss with their clients this new option of new settlement negotiations, and everyone will return on February 1st to find out what this decision will be.
Yeah, we on Legal Faceoff reached out to Dan Webb, who has represented the defendants, and also Barry Montgomery, who is now representing the plaintiff, and they have told us that given that they're back in court on February 1st, they didn't have a comment. But yeah, really interesting to see what will happen, whether they will settle or whether they're going to ask for a new trial. We've been joined on Legal Faceoff on WGN Plus by Laura Wood. Laura is a staff writer for the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Her work can be found at chicagolawbulletin.com. Laura, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed on this really interesting case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we close out the Legal Faceoff WGN Plus, as we always do, with our legal grab bag. Two heavy cases involving the Supreme Court. We've got the Obama immigration executive action. We'll start there, Rich.
Yeah, Supreme Court is in session now. They agreed this week to review a couple interesting cases. They agreed to review Obama's deferred deportation program. Basically, 26 states have sued, arguing that his November 2014 executive action on immigration is unconstitutional. That action by Obama allowed immigrants to stay here who have lived here for at least 5 years. And also, if they were the parents of U.S. citizens, it allowed them to gain legal permanent status. So, we'll report back on the result of that one. Also, another interesting case involves a convicted governor, something we're familiar with here in Illinois, and actually has some impact on Blagojevich. They agreed to consider whether former Virginia Governor Robert McDonnell was wrongly convicted. McDonnell's brief says basically that he was convicted for engaging in what he called ordinary politics, turning nearly every elected official into a felon. Who does that sound like? I mean, that's exactly what Blagojevich is saying, that he was just engaged in normal horse trading and politics. So everyone who follows the Blago case thinks that the Supreme Court would never touch it. If they accepted the review in this case, why wouldn't they accept his case, right?
Right. Yeah, it makes sense.
We'll see. Maybe some hope for Blago.
One of the most interesting presidential election periods that I can remember, and this one is spiraling all over the place, namely with Ted Cruz. Is he eligible to run for president? He was born in Canada.
Best news I've ever heard. Because
Trump
always
is coming out against your Canadians,
yeah, my,
big time.
My desire to be president.
My dream
of being U.S. president was always deflated because I thought, you know, you have to be a naturalized citizen. The question with Cruz is, I mean, a lot of people are saying that he can. I personally think that, you know, why would the U.S. Constitution use the words natural born citizen if it didn't mean someone born on U.S. soil? I mean, it seems clear to me. It's also interesting that a lot of like people who consider themselves strict constructionists decide to pick and choose. You know, like if you're going to be a strict constructionist,
Either you're going to be on the right with the strict constructionists, or you're going to be on the left with the interpreters. But
you know, I mean, there are people like Lawrence Tribe, who was called out by Cruz in the debate last week, who says adamantly that there's no way the Constitution can be read to include Cruz, who was born in Canada. Remember, he was born and lived in Canada for a while. It wasn't like McCain, who was born in a U.S. territory on a...
Marine base.
Right. I mean, he was born and lived in Canada for a while. Yes, his mother was born in Delaware, but to me, I agree with Trump. It's at least an issue. It's at least something that needs to be litigated and decided.
I'm surprised that Trump is starting to pick apart every single candidate on the stage now.
Yeah, what a shock.
And now
yeah.
He's aligning with Sarah Palin.
Did everyone catch those rally quotes yesterday?
Whose voice I can't get out of my head. I mean, just hearing her yesterday for the first time in months, like that voice gets in your head.
You could put Tina Fey and Sarah Palin next to each other, and I could not tell the difference.
I could see Russia from my house.
Yeah. You know, but seriously, wasn't Obama born to... His mother was American, but I thought he was born outside the continental U.S., right?
You and every other birther who tries
No. I seriously thought he was born in, like, Indonesia.
Well, because you're part of the right-wing wing nuts who think that. But that's a good point, because if you thought Obama... Like, if you're a Republican and you fought Obama thinking wrongly that he was born overseas, he was born in Hawaii, right, which is a U.S. state the last time I checked. But if you do believe
with that manufactured birth,
if you believe that is like if you're Donald Trump and you think that he was born in Nigeria, same thing, why wouldn't that apply to Cruz?
At least Trump's consistent with his attitude on it.
Interesting. We'll see.
Uber is extremely popular in big cities, very popular here in Chicago, but we have a suit involving one of the Uber drivers, Jason.
Yeah, who didn't see that video of the Uber Taco Bell manager who pummeled the Uber driver? I think it was on New Year's Eve, too, but the Uber driver posted the video on YouTube, and there's criminal charges pending against the Taco Bell corporate manager, Benjamin Golden, but now he's filed a $5 million counterclaim against the Uber driver, and he's stating that it was so extreme as to exceed all bounds that usually tolerated in a civilized community. Even I think this is a little hokey. The video is pretty clear that he's punching and beating this Uber driver to the point where the Uber driver pepper sprays him, so I don't know.
What's happened to society? This is
what is it? It's runaway.
Let's
justice.
Go. Let's go to our standard runaway lawsuits. I mean, you beat the hell out of an Uber driver, caught on video, and then you turn around and sue.
Yeah, I don't. Thank did he God. Have an attorney? I don't think so. I think most attorneys have too good a moral conscience.
Yeah, I'm sure he couldn't find someone to file that complaint for.
Oh,
him.
He did, Courtney Pilchman.
Yes. Thank you, Courtney.
Thanks, Courtney, for keeping justice rolling.
And thanks for keeping us busy. This might be the favorite case of mine on the surface that we've had on Legal Face Off: Beastie Boys v. Monster Energy.
Yeah, there was a
two things that Sam knows very well.
Yes.
This hits back to Rich's Canadian home. There was a Canadian promotional video that was about 4 minutes long that Monster developed, and they used excerpts from 5 Beastie Boys songs. There was actually a lawsuit, and they were awarded $2.4 million in damages in a Manhattan federal court. So that it has settled. Monster did file an appeal, but they dropped their appeal of that. And so there was a settlement between Monster and Beastie Boys, although there's one less Beastie Boy now.
Favorite Beastie Boys song?
Sabotage.
I mean, I got to go with the one I do a lot when I do karaoke. I mean, Fight for Your Right, it's a little bit of a layup, but I love Fight
I'll go
for
with
Your
Sabotage,
right.
too.
Nice.
And there's nothing like when I'm really writing a brief, I mean, just putting on Sabotage in the office.
We close out the legal grab bag on WGN Plus with the IKEA wardrobe situation.
Yeah, I mean, really, one of those cases you got to shake your head at. There was a driver, a chauffeur, basically, to the Swedish ambassador at the UN, who said that he was tortured because his boss, the ambassador, forced him to put together a massive IKEA wardrobe. Who's put together one of the IKEA products? I actually represent IKEA. Great company.
Yeah.
I own a lot of their products, but, man, they are tough to put together.
The savings is, I mean, you save money, but you have to put it together yourself. And when you open that box and you spread out those parts, it is the scariest feeling in the world.
Well, how about the instructions? It's like, you know, they got that one generic Swedish guy who's, like, smiling if he's doing it right and grimacing if he's doing it wrong.
And then they just expand the entire thing and show you how all the screws go in, and you really can't duplicate it.
I'm left with like 15 screws that should have been in there. Anyway, this guy says that he was a chauffeur and that handyman wasn't part of his job description when he was asked to put together a 225-pound piece of furniture by himself back in 2012. He said that the assembly put him or left him with life-altering disability, and he's asking for asking for $1.7 million, alleging that he was hurt on the job and also citing discrimination from his superior. So the lesson being, get some help if you're building IKEA stuff.
You know, to IKEA's credit, they actually do have certified installers that will come to your house and put that together. I actually had to hire one for a big project in our office.
Yeah, they're great guys. They came. It took them about 15 minutes to put together something I tried to put together in 7 hours.
The entire Lenkoff family could not put together in a week.
The other lesson to be learned, if you need something from IKEA, don't go in August. Because you are bombarded with every college kid in the country.
Yeah.
You will go insane.
Right.
So that about does it for Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. For anything you may have missed, WGNplus.com. For this full episode, for past episodes, for Rich, for Jason, I'm Sam. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.